Hello and welcome to Science World. Today, Roseanne Scherbo gives us a preview of the UN Climate Conference that will run from December 1st through the 12th in Lima, Peru. Conference attendees will be working on a new international climate treaty to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which expired in 2012. Zlatis Ahok tells us that astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti took a little bit of her native Italy when she was sent up to the International Space Station as one of its newest crew members. And Nobel laureate Dr. David Baltimore joins us on today's one-on-one segment to talk about a new way to fight diseases such as HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria that he and his colleagues at the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, have been working on. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA Science, Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. Climate watchers will be focused on Lima, Peru from December 1st through the 12th as representatives of 200 countries gather for critical negotiations on a new climate treaty. It would replace the Kyoto Protocol, the global agreement that expired in 2012. Roseanne Scherbel has this report.
The meeting in Lima sets the stage for Paris in 2015, when nations will come together to agree on a binding climate treaty, says Jennifer Morgan, global director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute.
That all countries would be part of, which is one of the differences of the past. And that would stick around for a while. That would be a global agreement for decades to come. That would bring countries back to the table to strengthen their commitment to solving the problem.
Scientists affirm with increased certainty that the planet is getting hotter. Study after study shows that the world is well on its way toward a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature above pre-industrial levels. Experts say that would trigger extreme weather and rising seas, problems of global magnitude. The studies also show that climate-changing emissions from fossil fuels are to blame. Lima is about getting those emissions in check. Morgan points to growing momentum to get that done. In September, the United Nations held a climate summit to engage heads of state and industry leaders, and about 700,000 people crowded streets in New York City and elsewhere for the People's Climate March.
Then bounce into European heads of state in October saying, here's our offer to reduce at least 40% emissions. And then the U.S.-China announcement recently, where those two countries came forward in a pretty historic announcement of what they're willing to do on their numbers and their willingness to work together.
In that agreement between the world's top polluters, the U.S. committed to reducing emissions between 26 and 28% by 2025. And for the first time, China put a timetable on its actions, saying emissions would peak by 2030. Morgan says to get there, China must begin making massive cuts now.
It's not like they're going to wait 16 years. They actually have to shut down coal-fired power plants. They have to build up renewable energy. They have to be much more efficient in order to turn that curve.
The deal puts China in a leadership role for the first time. Other countries are expected to put their reduced emissions commitments on the table by March. Morgan says the U.S.-China announcement is a strategic move that could energize other nations to do more.
If you look at developed countries, it's fair to say that Australia or Canada haven't indicated when they are going to table their offer. Well, if China can offer something, certainly they can offer something too. And in developing countries, I think a country like India or Brazil, I think now are challenged to table their offers as well.
Morgan says it's critical to close the emissions gap between what is needed and what countries are expected to pledge. She says each nation will make reductions in its own way through national policies and laws, but only a global pact with binding commitments can exert pressure to get the job done.
So it's in the interest of every country to actually have a global approach so that they can be sure that what they're doing is being mirrored by others. You don't get that through bilateral deals. You don't get all of the emissions in place, and you don't take care of the most vulnerable countries around the world adequately. So you need to do this global. It's challenging, it's messy, but it's fundamental to move forward.
Morgan hopes that the Lima meeting will end with a text for a new treaty, one that will guide negotiators and lead governments to act. Roseanne Scherbel, VOA News, Washington.
Italian-style espresso coffee has fans all over the world. Now Italian coffee makers are working to create a device that will be able to produce espresso in weightless conditions on the International Space Station. Zlata Sahok has this report.
Many people cannot imagine life without coffee, and for most Italians, coffee means espresso, a thick brew prepared in a special coffee machine. So when Italian astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti headed for the International Space Station earlier this month, her compatriots worried how she would survive there for 6 months, drinking only instant coffee. To help Cristoforetti and other espresso lovers in orbit, the famed Turin-based coffee maker Lavazza and engineering firm Argotech, which specializes in making space food, joined forces to produce a coffee machine that would work at zero gravity.
We had to figure out how to make coffee on the station exactly like we make it on Earth. The other difficulty was complying with safety measures in order to qualify the machine as onboard software on the International Space Station.
The machine called ISS Espresso overcomes the absence of gravity by firing pressurized water through capsules of coffee. Cristoforetti took it with her for testing when she blasted off into orbit on November 23rd.
The concept of this machine was for an experiment. So we started as a technology demonstration experiment, but NASA was very much interested in getting this machine and keeping most likely this machine for a long time. So not only for brewing a few coffees, but actually for keeping on the station. So this means that most likely, if everything goes well after the technology demonstration, the machine will be kept on the International Space Station, available for all the astronauts that we're rotating on the station.
Italians consider themselves great connoisseurs of coffee, perhaps with good reason.
We are very proud, not only as Italians, but also as residents of Turin. The first espresso machine was created in Turin in 1884, so about 130 years ago. And today, in 2014, another two Turin-based realities, Lavazza and Argotech, developed a machine that will bring espresso not only across the world, but even in space.
Besides espresso, the ISS espresso machine is capable of preparing tea and clear soup. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Researchers have invented a new material that can draw heat out of buildings and send it, along with the sun's radiating warmth, into the coldness of outer space. The revolutionary coating can cool buildings even on hot days. Jessica Berman reports.
The unique cooling material is an ultra-thin multi-layered sheet that could be installed on a roof like solar panels. But instead of turning sunlight into energy, it turns heat into invisible light and beams it away as infrared radiation. Stanford University electrical engineer Professor Shan-Hui Fan explains that the panels, which include a layer of material similar to what's found in sand, act like a kind of high-tech mirror, both siphoning heat out of the buildings and reflecting the sun's rays, sending both 100 kilometers up into the coldness of outer space.
It's a structure that cools itself without electricity input, even under the sun. So what it does is basically radiate heat to outer space and also reflect the sunlight so it doesn't get heat up by the sun. And the net result is you get something that if you put on a roof will have a temperature below ambient air temperature by a significant amount.
The panels, which are cool to the touch even in the sun, can reduce the indoor temperature to nearly 5 degrees Celsius below the temperature outside. The heat is sent directly into space at a frequency that allows it to pass through the atmosphere without warming the air, almost, Fun says, like having a window into space. He says one possible use for the panels would be in buildings in developing countries that have no access to electricity or air conditioning.
In areas where one is off-grid, there's significant potential benefit. For example, for storing medicine or even food, in many of these situations, being able to reduce the temperature is important. and this will provide a way to do it.
The Stanford researchers, who describe the technology on a small scale in the journal Nature, say the main challenge is engineering actual cooling systems using the high-tech panels. One possibility is formulating a cooling spray that could be applied to existing solid structures. They believe the technology could be scaled up in the next 3 to 5 years. Researchers note that as much as 15% of the energy used in the United States is spent powering air conditioning systems, money that could be saved in the long run after the initial cost of outfitting buildings with the cooling material. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time again for our weekly Science World Quick Quiz. A few minutes ago, Roseanne Scurbel gave us a preview of the UN Climate Conference that starts on Monday in Lima, Peru. Delegates to the conference are expected to continue their work in developing a new global climate agreement to replace the Kyoto Protocol, which expired in 2012. When was the Kyoto Protocol signed? Was it A, November 23, 1990, B, March 20, 2000, or C, December 11, 1997. Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
The intense efforts to find better treatments and a vaccine for Ebola are moving ahead at what one researcher describes as warp speed. And look, has the latest.
Health workers in West Africa are still struggling to get suspected Ebola patients to come forward and go into isolation at treatment units or ETUs so they won't infect others. It's been a hard sell, in part because those ETUs can't actually offer much in the way of treatment. There is currently no cure for Ebola. Clinics in West Africa can give supportive care, like rehydration therapy, to help the patient's bodies fight off the virus. But Ebola kills between 50 and 80% of those infected. However, that picture could be improving. In December, scientists will begin testing three possible treatments for Ebola at clinics in Guinea and Liberia, run by Doctors Without Borders. They will be testing two antiviral drugs, as well as a treatment using the blood and plasma of Ebola survivors, whose antibodies may help other patients fight off the virus. MSF says these trials are, quote, accelerated and mark unprecedented international collaboration. Still, MSF Medical Director Annick Antieren says don't expect a miracle cure just yet.
On espère évidemment que ce soit des traitements qui aient une vraie valeur ajoutée. Le produit miracle, ça semble.
She says any treatment will be more effective when it's given early, before the virus spreads everywhere in the body. But not all patients come in during the first 48 hours. But these trials are just the beginning. She says there are other drugs they can test. People evacuated and treated in the U.S. and Europe have been getting combinations of treatments, so that's an option as well. New Ebola cases are being reported every day in West Africa. This epidemic is far from over. Still, thoughts are already turning to the future, to the next outbreak. There is talk of ramped-up surveillance and the creation of rapid response units that could go into the bush at the first signs. The WHO has called for the development of a rapid diagnostic tool, a simple test that could give results in 30 minutes without the need of a lab. Liberia's Assistant Health Minister, Tolbert Nyansua.
Unless we can get a vaccine to immunize people against the disease and eradicate the disease, it will be a disease that will always come back because we have the history in other countries in East Africa.
The Democratic Republic of Congo just beat its seventh Ebola outbreak since the disease was first discovered there in 1976. Uganda has had five outbreaks since 2000. In West Africa this year, Ebola spread in a way never before seen, on a scale never before seen. The virus reached urban areas like Monrovia. It traveled by plane to the U.S. and Europe, sparking global alarm. That alarm and the epidemic in West Africa spurred on what had been stalled research efforts. Dr. Myron Levine of the Center for Vaccine Development at the University of Maryland is working on a vaccine trial in Mali. He says it typically takes about a decade to get a vaccine tested and licensed for general use. But this is uncharted territory.
We've already kind of done the impossible. And lots of folks said, there's no way that we could go from a vaccine in August that had never been in a human being and complete dose response phase one in West Africans within a few months. They said it was impossible. Well, impossible, you can cross out that word. It's been done.
Researchers have finished injecting the last of 91 Malian health workers with a test vaccine against the Zaire strain of the virus. The 91 volunteers were given varying doses and are being monitored. Their immune responses will, quote, peak 28 days post-injection. Results are expected at the end of December. If all goes well, a larger trial testing the efficacy of the vaccine is expected to start as soon as the first quarter of 2015. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
Meanwhile, U.S. researchers say an experimental Ebola vaccine is showing promising signs during its initial testing.
The results with the higher dose were really quite favorable. Virtually all of the people who received the higher dose got a very robust antibody response, which is the classical response that vaccines elicit. So that's good news, and that's the response that was comparable to the responses that we saw in the animals that were ultimately protected.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The news from the National Institutes of Health comes as the World Health Organization reports the death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa nears 5,700, amid signs the spread of the virus is slowing but has not stopped. The UN agency says the number of newly reported cases is stable in Guinea and stable or declining in Liberia, but may still be increasing in Sierra Leone, which accounted for nearly two-thirds of all new cases. The continuous spread of Ebola has health researchers at NIH and around the world scrambling to find a vaccine to fight off the disease.
When you're dealing with vaccines, there are always little glitches that arise that might delay it one way or the other. But for the most part, we're hoping to start this much, much larger efficacy trial in first Liberia to determine if it actually works.
Dr. Fauci says the vaccine could be put to its first major test by the middle of next year. Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. Our question was, when was the Kyoto Protocol signed? Was it A, November 23rd, 1990, B, March 20th, 2000, or C, December 11th, 1997? The answer is C, the Kyoto Protocol to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change was signed on December 11, 1997 at the annual UN Climate Change Conference that was held in Kyoto, Japan. The treaty came into force on February 16, 2005, and it expired on December 31, 2012. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet, voanews.com/science.
Scientists have been hard at work to develop vaccines to fight potentially deadly diseases such as HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. While much of the research conducted so far has seen some degree of success, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration hasn't licensed any vaccine to fight those diseases. Nobel laureate Dr. David Baltimore and his colleagues at the California Institute of Technology are taking a new approach to fight infectious diseases. Called vectored immunoprophylaxis, or VIP, this new method will provide the body with step-by-step instructions so that it can produce the exact antibodies that are needed to fight a particular disease. Dr. David Baltimore joins us for this week's one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and the promise of the VIP method in fighting disease. Dr. Baltimore, why do researchers seem to be struggling in their work of developing vaccines for such lethal diseases? And what has made it so difficult and such a challenge?
Well, there usually are different reasons for each organism. Some organisms mutate away from vaccines very easily. Some have ways of changing their structure so that you're not fighting one organism. It seems like you're fighting many. And some just hide away the crown jewels so that the immune system can't see them. That's HIV does that. HIV also mutates extensively. Malaria keeps changing its immunogenicity. And for Ebola, we're not exactly sure why it's so difficult, but it has been difficult. On the other hand, things like polio, mumps, measles, chickenpox, smallpox have been relatively easy to protect against because they're very stable targets and they don't change a lot. And every immune system is capable of making a range of antibodies or T cells that protect against those particular organisms. So for those, all you need to do is make a vaccine and get it into people before they see the disease, and it works like a charm.
Doctor, you and your team have taken on a new approach to this challenge and are working on something called VIP.
Now, right.
What is VIP, and could you tell us about this unique new approach in fighting diseases?
We call it VIP. It's vectored immunoprophylaxis. But what we do is to say, if we can make antibodies to the organism, instead of waiting to get the body to make those antibodies, we're going to program the body to make them. And by programming, I mean we use a viral vector that brings into the body the genetic information for making the antibodies. And we can do that very simply, very safely, and we can get antibody made in an experimental animal for the lifetime of the animal. And we're pretty confident that we can do it for at least 10 years in humans.
Doctor, can you fill us in, please, on some of the progress and successes you've come across so far related to developing VIP?
Yeah, we developed it mainly for HIV because I think that's the greatest need in the world today, a vaccine against HIV. And that's going into clinical testing in humans now, but we still don't have any data on humans. But we have very good data that it's highly protective for experimental animals.
Doctor, would this approach using VIP be a relevant approach in fighting diseases such as tuberculosis, malaria, or Ebola?
We have shown and have published in collaboration with others that it will work for malaria. We've shown that it works for hepatitis C. We've shown that it works for influenza, sort of universal antibody that we can use. So you get long-term protection instead of needing a new vaccine every year. So, yeah, we have demonstrated in animals that it will work for a variety of organisms.
Doctor, while you're working on the VIP treatment for perhaps a application to fight the flu season is upon us. So right now, what is the best way to protect ourselves from getting influenza?
Well, there's no question that taking the existing vaccine is the best thing we can do. We need to take it every year. But every year, we work very hard to make sure that that vaccine covers the strains of influenza that are in circulation that year.
We've been hearing a lot about the various viruses, the diseases that have captured the most press time, including HIV, TB, malaria, and now Ebola.
Right.
Are there any other challenges, any other diseases, viruses that are prevalent in developing countries that you're looking at?
Not really. There is a new virus coming down the pike called chikungunya virus, and that will be very important to protect against in the future because it's a virus that's transmitted by mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes are moving north as global warming takes hold. And so that's going to be a very important new organism to protect against. We already have reason to be thinking about West Nile virus, which appeared on the scene not long ago, again, probably as a function of global warming. Maybe not. But anyway, it's a problem now that we have to deal with.
That was Dr. David Baltimore, a Nobel laureate and a researcher and professor of biology at the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech. Dr. Baltimore also served as president of the Pasadena, California-based school from 1997 to 2005. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.